The joy of ebooks is that great stories are just a click away. For our podcast listeners, we have a great offer on Luke Harding's book Mafia State, a menacing tale of life as a journalist in present-day Russia. I'll tell you more at the end of the show.
The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Parliament's back and there's a rare glimmer of good news for the government. Unemployment is down and inflation is slowing. New parliamentary term, new rush of policy ideas. The Prime Minister brainstorms a new idea on energy without telling his energy secretary. And all that before David Cameron jetted off to another Brussels summit with his party showing increasing impatience over Europe. And the week after the EU bagged the Nobel Peace Prize, France and Germany set off a war of words on austerity. Plus, Plebgate reignites. Andrew Mitchell faces fresh calls to resign as his MPs refuse to forget that altercation with a bobby back in August. So plenty to get through. And joining me for all of this, we have The Observer's political editor, Toby Helm, The Guardian political commentator, Anne Perkins, and down the line from Westminster, our good friend Michael White. A warm welcome to you all. Now, it's become something of a defining motif of the slump. A batch of official stats are released, and cue much bafflement and scratching of heads from mainstream economists who had not predicted what would happen at all. Despite pancake flat economic growth, UK unemployment fell to its lowest level for 15 months, with the number of young job seekers falling very sharply. Now, Mike, if you'd told all these economic wise men and women a few years ago that the economy was going to contract as massively as we are told it has done by 6 or 7%, but employment would only go down by 2%, none of them would have believed you.
No, but then if you'd told me that bankers would be selling products they didn't understand, nobody would believe me either. No, the economists have had a bad war during this recession like everybody else. It's not clear what's going on, but it is good news whichever way you see it. A lot of these jobs are part-time, but as somebody wisely says, part-time is better than no time. And not everybody, of course, wants a full-time job, although I think just over 1 million people would like one if they could get one and they're on part-time. But it is a puzzle, and all the newspapers and all the commentators reflect that puzzlement. Is the economy growing faster than people think? Why can't we measure it? Are the stats wrong? Probably not. What's going on? Youth unemployment dropping by, I think it's 50,000. That's very good too. It's about 20% in this country, which is far too high, much higher elsewhere. In the Eurozone, whose overall unemployment, of course, is much higher, about over 2% higher.
Toby, you know, the jury is out. We haven't had this mix before of desperate economic growth on the one hand and relatively tolerable employment figures on the other. It could be that the employment side of it, which is easier to count, is right, and the GDP figures aren't quite as bad as we've been thinking. I'm wondering where this leaves Labour, who have a very strong strategy for opposing the coalition while we're in a slump, but won't have a strategy at all, will they, if it turns out we're not in one after all?
Well, they've got to be very careful on both fronts, on the economic growth front and the employment front. I think with the on the jobs front, what Labour is saying and will continue to say is that these are not real jobs, they're not full-time jobs. They're people, they're employers parking their full-time workers on part-time jobs rather than laying them off because it's cheaper in many ways to do so. It's cheaper because of the way the labour market regulations work now. It's often cheaper to keep an employer on less hours than it is to actually get rid of them. So they can play that game. But I agree with you, on the economy, they're in an extremely difficult position, Labour now, because if the economy does come back by any amount, even a small amount of economic growth, the Tories can cheer that to the rafters and the public.
We've turned the corner.
Yeah, we've turned the corner, anything. And Labour has to, it can't deny that that's good news, but it's somehow got to make out that it's not as good news as it should be. And that's a very, very difficult trick to pull off.
And the other difficulty here, Anne, I imagine, is that once you've got a bit of growth, you know, we know what the Ed Balls emergency medicine is about a VAT cut and some stuff on house building and so on. If we were in a position where we just had tolerable growth rather than, you know, even booming growth, it wouldn't be able to say it was an emergency that needed an emergency VAT cut. Do you get a sense he's got something else up his sleeve to say?
I don't know about that, but I think he needs to be. He certainly needs to be thinking about it. The whole strategy has been, and apparently entirely accurately, has been on the presumption of a double dip recession. And he's clearly got to think his way through this one, because there's no one of the other extraordinary things about this recession, although it's perhaps not unique to recessions in this country, is that people kind of they kind of hate the impact on their own budgets, but they are still inclined to believe that the government is doing the right thing, and that is always a difficulty for a Labour opposition. I tell you the other thing, though, if we're kind of puzzling over these employment figures, it strikes me that this is one result of a very much weaker trade union movement. And that it's notable that growth where it comes now is coming in the non-unionised sector. And there are, you can obviously see, as a straightforward economist, you might argue that's a good thing. But of course, there's a huge knock-on effect of that in terms of the quality of the jobs and the pay.
The pay. I mean, pay is still very
And conditions of work.
Yeah. And I mean, if you know, you've looked before at the 80s and the 30s, and there you had a right-wing government building a winning coalition in difficult times because the pain was being experienced by the 10 or 15% who didn't have a job at all. Whereas now what we're seeing is most people clinging onto a job, but almost no one getting a pay rise.
Well, that's the alternative to the European model, which has much more rigid labour market. Those who've got jobs riot to defend them alongside those who haven't got jobs but would like them, unaware that they have different interests, not the same interests. In the UK, we've sacrificed all sorts of things for a more flexible labour market. Labour hoarding, as Toby said, which is probably the right thing to do. And the result is, yeah, there's downward pressure on wages. But that is a form of work sharing, and we could argue all day about it, but it's a clear choice, and we have more people in work, more than at any time since, what is it, 1971?
And
29 point whatever is million, a lot of people.
A lot of people, and you could argue, and from, I don't know, sociologist point of view, you know, we know there's particular problems you get when people lose their job and mental health, and there's lots of tolls from it. But still, the raw politics of this, surely, are that with the pain being shared far and wide rather than concentrated on a minority, it's harder for a government to hang on to office, you'd think.
Except for this, the rival factor that people believe the government is doing the right thing,
yep,
even when it is affecting their own living standards so sharply and painfully.
Toby, one place where the big squeeze that we keep hearing about is really showing up at the moment is every time anyone opens their gas bill. David Cameron had some sort of wheeze to deal with that he's been coming up with yesterday.
Yes, at Prime Minister's Questions, it was pretty obvious from very soon after he said it that the Prime Minister hadn't really meant to announce that the government was going to ensure in law that all energy companies should offer customers the lowest tariff. But Number 10, so thrown by this announcement by the Prime Minister, actually decided to insist that he had meant it, so therefore digging themselves deeper into the problem. And this morning we find the whole thing predictably unravelling as the energy ministers from DEC make abundantly clear that this, what the Prime Minister announced yesterday, is in fact not yet policy. So we have a kind of an inevitable and rather predictable omni-shambles on the energy front.
It's quite serious, isn't it, Mike? I mean, it's always serious to look incompetent, but particularly on something like this, where most people care an awful lot. They feel fleeced by the energy companies. The Prime Minister says he's going to help them out, and then maybe he's not after all.
Well, everybody makes mistakes, and the answer is to put your hands up and admit that you did. It slightly, in Cameron's case, reinforces the feeling that, that they didn't do enough work in opposition, the sort of thing Tony Blair would say if he were on the phone here. You've got to pin down your policies, you've got to be clear, you've got to work really hard. You get turned over and muddled all the time. And the coalition gives the impression, I know it's a coalition, and that creates problems because you have to knit together different views, but the coalition gives the impression a lot, and Cameron in particular, of, you know, not working into the wee small hours, of being too much. Remember that original idea he had of being the chairman of the board? But what you find when you're in Number 10, you have to drive the departments, you have to be good on detail, you have to have your own people at Number 10 who are monitoring what the departments, Andrew Lansley at Health, for example, are up to, and you've got to be a better grip than Cameron clearly has, and this is just another example. They'll get over it. But it is a sensitive subject, you're quite right.
Come back, workaholic Gordon Brown, all is forgiven?
No. That's the other side. Maybe Cameron's reacting against that sort of micromanagement of everything.
But it's extraordinary, isn't it, that hashtag Omnishambles kind of meets both the kind of the chillaxed chairman of the board and the neurotic workaholic Prime Minister Model 2. The same result, the same disaster's result.
Well, so what is it? Come back, Tony, all is forgiven in that case. I mean, just in terms of how they, not the policies, but how he did the job, Toby Helm, it does look quite good in the light.
I don't think Blair was a particular stickler for detail. I think, there's always talk about sort of sofa government and, you know, doing things fairly informally, and that led him into plenty of problems. I mean, I think one of the problems at the moment is that Cameron has his eye on too many strains within the government and
the government or the Conservative Party?
Well, both, actually. I mean, it was clear at Prime Minister's questions yesterday that the Andrew Mitchell thing was preoccupying him because, as Miliband laid in over that, and all eyes were on Andrew Mitchell. And it was just after that section that Cameron announced this supposed policy on energy. And that's one of his problems. Another of his problems is that he's having now to govern as much in response to Tory backbenchers as he is in coalition with the Lib Dems. So he's often forgetting the Lib Dems and forgetting what they're saying and going with the Tory line. And you can see that on Europe. You can see it on a number of issues now.
Let's just hear, pause there to hear a bit of Prime Minister's questions. As you say, Andrew Mitchell's altercation with the policeman reared its head once again.
Mr. Ed Miliband, this is what the Mayor of London, Mr. Speaker, his new best mate, said last year at Conservative Party conference. I reckon we need to make it clear that if people swear at the police, then they must expect to be arrested. Oh, well, he says he didn't. He says from a sedentary position he didn't. Maybe he'll tell us what he actually did say. According to the official police report, and I quote, a man claiming to be the chief whip called the police plebs, told them they should know their place and use other abusive language. Can the Prime Minister now tell us, did the chief whip use those words?
Prime Minister.
What the chief whip did and what the chief whip said were wrong, right? I'm absolutely clear about that. And that's why it's important that the Chief Whip apologised. That apology has been accepted by the
Order! Order! I said a moment ago that the Leader of the Opposition must and would be heard. The same goes for the Prime Minister. He must and will be heard. The Prime Minister.
What the Chief Whip did and said was wrong. And that is why it is important that he apologised and apologised properly. That apology has been accepted by the officer concerned. It's been accepted by the head of the Metropolitan Police. And that is why this government will get on with the big issues of helping Britain compete and succeed in the world.
And the 1922 Committee of Backbenchers met this week and decided to back the Chief Whip, albeit a bit grudgingly, you feel. Do you think he can hang on to his job?
I think he looks oddly safer. It's terribly embarrassing to kind of be pinned down at this point on this story because you kind of never know quite what might happen. And if we, you know, the stories that his deputy was threatening to resign if he didn't go, we don't kind of, you know, you never quite know the tone of the 22. Might know better than me. And I mean, I felt after PMQs that he was safer. But when I heard that John Randall was threatening to resign, I thought, you know, maybe the feelings are running too high and he can't hang on. I mean, for what it's worth, I'm broadly with Chris Mullin on this. I think he probably shouldn't be hounded out because, as Mike just said, with typical generosity, we all make mistakes. That, you know, he shouldn't have done it, but he did. He's apologised. The apology's been accepted. And it is undoubtedly true that the Police Federation is at war with the government and it definitely would love to claim the Chief Whip scalp.
Yeah, Mullin made the important point, and he's a man who campaigned against police injustices, the Guildford and Birmingham bombing cases, knows what he's talking about, chairman of the Home Affairs Committee, said the Police Federation are bullies. And he's a fair-minded man too. He's Labour, but ex-MP. And he was, I thought, spot on the money. The way the West Mercia Police Federation behaved after seeing Mitch was absolutely disgraceful. But they're not such a hot police force.
But isn't the problem here just, you know, the lingering problem that normally in these things you can apologise and move on, but you need to accept what you've done, and that's all still disputed, Mike.
Yeah, they've made an awful mess of it. It's a difficult situation, I grant you that, and I'm afraid I can imagine Andrew Mitchell being a bit hoity with the police officers, and he shouldn't be that, but the fact is he did, but he apologised, and other people are exploiting it. The right-wing press is on his aid budget, with its usual opportunism. The Police Federation, working with the tabloids on this particular occasion, and of course Labour completely overdoing it. They're still at it this morning in the chamber when we're meant to be worrying about energy tariffs and real life issues, and we're making witty jokes about constituents being fined for being rude to policemen in Sunderland or in South Wales.
So it can seem a bit ridiculous if you drag it on, but Toby, do you think is he popular with? I mean,
he's not particularly popular, but that's partly why he was appointed chief whip, because he is, he's a hard man and he can snarl at people as he did when he was running David Davis's campaign.
He's also an outsider,
campaign.
Isn't he? Exactly, as you said, yeah. He's a David Davis man.
I mean, yeah. I think the real problem for Cameron on this now is not the issue of whether he said it or whether he didn't say it or whether, you know, he's been rude to the police or row with the police. It's actually the problem of whether he can do his job as chief whip, which is a really, really important job. And if, you know, he looked like a very diminished figure yesterday in the Commons.
So he
rather enfeebled by the whole episode, I thought. And I think if his authority is gone, that's a really serious party management problem for Cameron.
What do you think of that, Mike? Because, I mean, if you were an awkward bugger of a Tory MP wanting to rebel on Europe or something, and he's saying, oh, you can't do this, it's embarrassing for the government.
Well, he's got to reassert his authority by a mixture of flattery and discipline. It's very difficult. They are a very rebellious parliament. People say MPs nowadays are supine and do what the whips tell them. It's not true. The Labour Parliament in 1997 was the most rebellious in living memory, and they've got more rebellious. And once you've rebelled once, a bit like virginity, you do it again. And this is true of this parliament. The stats are quite striking. You're meant to be the MP for your locality, standing up for your local hospital or whatever, standing up against the government. It's the Thatcher style of running against the government even when you're part of it. And that's hard to manage, and especially in a coalition where the left-wing Lib Dems and the right-wing Tories are all hacked off, and lots of them think other people have got jobs they should have. Mitchell's in a position, but it's up to him to get himself out. If he's not up to it, he'll fail and be moved, but I think he'll survive for the while.
Well, let's leave slanging matches to one side now and ho-ho, talk about Europe. David Cameron will be joining his EU counterparts in Brussels today for one of three summits that they plan to fit in before Christmas. On the official agenda, talks on advancing integration. But the real talking point will be the ever-present worry about Greece and Spain and the increasingly frosty relationship between Angela Merkel and the new French president, François Hollande. And we know that Hollande was elected on a promise to shake things up a bit. He's done that all right. You can see why Merkel was campaigning for Sarkozy now, can't you?
Well, and also Merkel and Sarkozy operated a very kind of important axis, and Hollande always made it perfectly clear he wasn't going to be part of that. And as you say, he was elected on a very distinctive, much more traditionalist French political agenda. He is undoubtedly making life very difficult for Merkel, possibly doing a very necessary thing.
And what do you think, Mike? I mean, do you think that Cameron's just going to be at the sidelines of this one, or do you think?
Well, that's certainly part of what François Hollande said in his interview with The Guardian and other European newspapers this morning at the Elysee. Angelique Christophis has got it in the paper. We want Britain to be part of it, but we're not going to force them to do anything, but they've chosen to stay out of the Eurozone. Pause for applause there for Gordon Brown. He never gets enough credit for that. And we'll do what is necessary. Sarkozy and Mrs. Merkel didn't particularly get on. Sarkozy, I don't think, doesn't get on with women he doesn't fancy. And I suspect Hollande and Merkel at a personal level get on fine, but they both have domestic constituencies. He's under pressure from the right and the left in France. They're disappointed on the left with what he's done so far. They've introduced a new enterprise bank overnight, a sort of thing the Germans have, and we're talking about having Vince Cable, but haven't yet got. But the whole Franco-German axis is based upon a deception, in a sense. Germany must pretend to be weaker than it is. France must always pretend to be stronger. We know which economy is driving Europe now, don't we? And Holland has a weak hand.
Its growth was slowing down as well this week.
But it's still enormously in surplus, and those IMF and WEO reports about the impact of cuts on domestic demand and employment, yeah, which is a very serious debate, still show over the long term surplus economies like Germany being heavily in surplus.
They're going to be in surplus, but if they start stagnating, Toby, do you think, like, you could imagine a world where Germany, what would happen if they start to feel the squeeze too? Will they become more enlightened? Yeah. Or?
Well, I mean, enlightened in what sense? I mean, I can remember...
Well, recognising that Europe's all in it together.
Okay, but I mean, I think as far as the kind of German argument, the German economic argument is, I mean, we hear it so often when it suits British politicians to slag off the German economy as somehow ill-conceived and sclerotic is often the word used. That's often the point at which the German economy actually bounces back, and the whole European social model shows that it has balancing factors in it which make it actually have a fairly even level of growth, if not dramatic surges up and down. It's fairly even. So I think the German economy actually is a much more steady model than many of those in Europe and will continue to grow, you know, with down periods in between. And I also think that, you know, from experience, the if we in Britain think that, the you know, somehow the Franco-German axis is prising apart in this current strain, yes, it's under strain, it's often under strain, but it always comes back. It's always the thing that drives on Europe.
So that's one bit of advice for the Foreign Office from Toby, Anne. But Britain does seem increasingly bent on ploughing its own farrow. We saw Theresa May stand up this week and say she was going to do this block opt-out. Well, didn't say she was, but was thinking about doing this block opt-out on all the cooperation arrest warrants and things.
We're in a really complicated position with Europe, and there isn't an easy answer. It's facile to pretend that there is. It's certainly facile to pretend that an in-out referendum is being pushed for now is one solution. But how do we cope with this drive to closer union, to closer integration, which is essential to make the Eurozone work, but which is going to exclude us, which might very well damage the city, in which we'll have less and less influence, and which might actually jeopardise the one thing that we most treasure in the EU, which is the single market. I really don't begin to have an answer for those things. I think they need to be discussed much more fully and openly than they are. But then, of course, we don't quite know what's going to happen out of these three summits anyway.
What we do know, Mike, is what people like Michael Gove are thinking, which is that single market you might be able to call their bluff on and say, look, we want the single market and nothing else. And if you want to land us with other stuff, we're gonna walk. Once that argument's up and running from really big players in the government like Gove, it's quite hard to put back in the box, isn't it?
Well, I'm old enough to remember when Michael Gove, Mickey, was still just a scribbling hack like the rest of us. And in the 1992 election, he came to some broadcast like this one and said, gosh, the Times is advocating that you don't vote Labour or Tory, you vote for the Eurosceptics. You'd have thought here he'd split the atom. And I don't take his views on Europe very seriously. He said he'd vote in the current circumstances if he had to, he'd vote to leave. But Gove isn't stupid, and therefore he must know that what he's saying isn't very believable, and he's playing to the gallery. I wonder why. I think Cameron doesn't want that binary yes-no. He wants to do what Harold Wilson did, renegotiate the treaties, which he didn't do really. It was all cosmetic. They went along with it in 1975. Will they go along with it this time? They're fed up with us. Theresa May wants to opt out of all sorts of law and order things, including the European arrest warrant, and then she wants to opt back into some of them. Dear Lord, these people have a major financial crisis on their hands, and they have better things to worry about than the manoeuvres of domestic British politics and the threat of which UKIP poses to David Cameron, which is what a lot of this is about.
It just seems to me
we need leadership. You need people to explain properly, which says, you know, lots of things wrong with the European Union. We can improve some of them, where we can withdraw from others, but let's be grown up. We're in it.
But I mean, don't you think, Anne,
like, really, are they going to say, well, you're out of the single market then? I mean, if you go and get very aggressive, as Charles de Gaulle might have done, you know, it wouldn't be the first time that a European had done this and said, right, we don't want anything to do with it, but we do want to stay in the single market.
He wasn't going to leave.
But would they really say, oh, we're going to start putting tariffs on British goods?
You can't see it. Well, I mean, I don't know I don't know the detail of the European mind, but obviously, you know, we're so integrated within the European economy now, despite not being in the Eurozone, that I can't see a de Gaulle moment arising. It's a bit like trying to, you know, take programs off your computer. You know, you keeps telling you that you'll lose something vital if you go. And I suspect we'll do what we always do. We'll find some kind of muddled compromise, but I think it's going to be very painful and very bitter, and you know, maybe one more step in the Tory agenda of Americanizing.
And I can't let you go. If we're talking about Europe coming to pieces, we've got to talk about the UK coming to pieces too. Toby, were you watching Alex Salmond's turn in the spotlight this week?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, you've got this extraordinary situation, linking it back to Europe, where you've got the Tory party desperately wanting to be staying within one union and seem to indicating that they want to get out of another one. It seems that as they have agreed on the question and as they've agreed on the way forward, that opinion is already slightly going against independence. But you can never underestimate Alex Salmond, and you can never underestimate events. So I think we're into for a fascinating year and a bit of campaigning, and this one could swing here and hither and thither, I think.
I don't think we should take any notice of the polls at this stage, which show the no's or the better off in camp being 2-1 ahead. As Toby says, a lot can happen. Also, don't forget, well, the striking thing about this yes-no question for the Scottish referendum, it excludes what a majority of Scottish voters are thought to want, which is more devolution.
I'm wondering...
Well, that's what the polls also say. Yeah. So which way will they jump? Will they jump to the yes camp? Hey, let's go the whole hog. Or as currently looks, they'll say, steady on, it's a wicked world. We better say no and stick with the Britain we are part of. Yeah. And nobody knows the answer to that at this stage. I would only make one point. It seems to me Alex Salmond is a panacea politician, a very talented one. He's a bit like the Tory Eurosceptics who say, oh God, we'd be able to sell more goods to Brazil if we weren't in the European Union. Nobody's stopping you selling more goods to Brazil, dears. We'd be able to do this, we'd be able to do that without England, we'd be able to do it without Europe. It's all fanciful nonsense in the real world. It's romantic, it's lovely, we like romance, I like romance, but it's romantic.
The politics will depend on if you can make independence look like some sort of a middle way, then it might become much more feasible to people. I mean, they're keeping
he's done the kind of easy things, but now he's got the really hard things to do, nuclear defence and
NATO. They're talking about this weekend,
yeah,
at the conference.
Yeah, NATO, and he's got, you know, I mean, curiously, in this, you know, you're talking about the polls being against independence in Scotland, they're massively pro and out vote for Europe. But and I wonder if actually when it comes down to, you know, if a referendum is, it should be a moment when people actually confront the realities of the decision they're making, you might end up with people preferring the status quo on both sides of the argument.
It's a hell of a gamble, so, both on Europe and on the Union with Scotland.
I mean, do you think this will be the strategy, though, Toby, just like, even if it's NATO and things that the SNP had particular lines on in the past, just to emphasise that independence as continuity is probably going to be your best way of getting a yes vote?
Certainly a way, yeah. And also quite heroic, I think. You know, if they can make
the
it to be a
brave heart approach.
A heroic policy. But also I think it's...
heroic
sort of
continuity.
Interestingly, I think it might also be tied... You know, what happens in this referendum to an extent might be tied to what happens to Cameron in domestic politics. If this government carries on being, you know, omni-shambolic, then that might persuade a few people in Scotland to go, you know, a bit more down the independence road. I think that there is an interesting potential correlation there.
And Mike, finally, I mean, I always have a little conspiracy theory here that someone as canny as Alex Salmond isn't going to have this referendum. He's going to find a way out if it looks like he's going to lose it decisively. But that has got much harder to sustain, that thought, hasn't it, now that this deal is done? Do you think he's still got a way out if it's obvious he's going to lose?
If you're crafty, you can get your way out of things. I mean, politics operates at a high level, lofty sentiments, Barack Obama's very good at them, and at a low level, Obama's not so good at that. Alex Salmond is actually pretty good at both, and low politics will get you out of all sorts of hole. He'd be able to blame London for postponing a referendum. Personally, I don't think he can or he will. You travel in optimism. He's a great opportunist. He's very adaptable. Look how he's abandoned the euro in favour of the crown, in favour of the sterling, abandoned the republic in favour of the queen. He wants to be part of a monetary union with two countries. What did he say the other day? Oh, votes for 16. He got that one. He's immensely flexible, Sam, and it's part of his dangerous charm.
Okay, on that ringing mixture of high and low notes, let's draw Politics Weekly to a close. My thanks to Michael White, to Anne Perkins and to Toby Helm. We'll be back for a bonus special Politics Weekly next Tuesday, following the third and final American presidential debate. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For a limited period only, we have an exclusive ebook offer for Guardian podcast listeners. Guardian columnist Luke Harding's Mafia State is a dark and ominous insight into the life of a journalist in present-day Russia. We're offering 30% off the list price of $4.99. All you have to do is go to the ebook store www.kobo.com, that's KOBO.com, and at checkout put in the discount code MAFIASTATE for your Guardian podcast offer.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.